Welcome back, listeners. This is Radio 74, and I'm Mario, the Artisan Rogue. Today, I'm talking about a little jaunt that I took downtown to go to the Nelson Atkins Museum. For those of you that haven't been to Kansas City or aren't familiar with the museum, it's probably the crown jewel of museums. Well, I say that. I'm kind of partial to the World War I Museum, but I really do love the Nelson Atkins Museum. Actually, let's be honest. I like all museums. I really do. There's always something new and interesting to discover in all of them. I really like the ones that actively try to, you know, switch things up on you and come up with new displays and all this other sort of stuff to see. And the museum here is no exception to that rule. I mean, it's definitely a, I would almost say a world-class one, and I sincerely mean that. Now, I'm not going to ruin anything for anybody that wants to go to the museum and just go in-depth or ad nauseum about what's there, you know, on display and that sort of thing. I mean, if you're interested in anything, you know, yes, of course, you know, it's the Nelson Atkins Art Museum. They have all kinds of things running from, well, I will tell you a few things. So let's go down that route. The first thing is they do have an extensive collection that contains anything from like postmodernism to pop art to ancient to, you know, medieval art to fairly modern stuff. And the reason I went there today was, let me kind of wax poetic on this for a little bit. If you end up working for a long time on any number of projects or whatever, sometimes a walk in the woods can do you good. Sometimes just taking a nap, sitting back, watching Netflix, doing something along that line can recharge you. For me, one of my favorite things to do is to go to a museum. It doesn't really matter which one, because as long as I can get my mind onto a different sort of realm or a different sort of thought process, I'm going to be doing a lot better if I can take that time. Now, I know that there's a lot of people out there that they just want to keep their nose to the grind. They just want to keep working as hard as they possibly can to go in a particular direction because, you know what, there's not that much time. I've got to get stuff finished. I've got to stay organized. I've got to stay on task. This is all true. But take it from me. I know myself, and I know how other people will probably work. There is a paradigm in our mind that will occur whenever you start getting burned out. On one side, you definitely want to stay focused and you want to be as productive as possible. Great. You know, nobody's telling you not to do that. But if you don't stand back and take a look at the work you're doing, you're going to run afoul and start making mistakes. This happens like, I mean, I'm making this podcast right now at what, midnight? And honestly, the thing is that I end up doing a lot more of my better creative stuff the later on that it gets in the evening. And I've never really figured that out why. I mean, there's the whole, you know, aspect of burning the midnight oil or staying up late, being a night owl. I was never really a night owl in work respect. When I was younger, I stayed up watching television and playing games at, you know, till whenever. Sometimes on school nights until I had to go to school the very next day and I just got cleaned up, got on the bus, and went to school. I couldn't do that now if I wanted to. But the thing is, when you're pushing that much effort into what you're working on, I don't care if you're self-proprietor or if this is just, you know, if you've got hobbies or things you want to try and accomplish while you've got a daytime job or any mix of that, you're still going to run into the situation where you need to take some time to move away from that. And for me, going to a museum kind of helps me out on that. It's actually a huge help. And the reason is because, you know, in my line of work, and it's really weird because I end up taking a real long look at a lot of my work. And some of it, you know, is personal. Some of it is very much the stuff I put out there for people to see. And I don't always have the capacity to look beyond that. I mean, I've got art books all over the place down here in the studio. I've got artwork hanging up from all kinds of other artists and just different things. You know, I collect all kinds of different stuff that has design and color and pattern and all that stuff, from random bits of material to fabrics to bits of wood that I found, you know, things like that that help inspire me. But I can have all of these elements, all of these things around me. And if I don't really look to see how other people historically have done things or what they've done with them or all, you know, or maybe what they haven't or have done with them, then I'm going to be working in a vacuum. And nobody really thrives in that. You really don't. So I took it upon myself to make sure that, like, whenever I can, I go to these museums, and whenever I go, I'm consciously looking for answers to problems I have. And I know that, you know, mentally, and I had even made a small list in my phone, and I was kind of flipping through that one when I was there. And there were a few of them. And here's an example. The very first one that I had was trying to think of new and innovative design concepts for some robots I've been working on. Now, don't get me wrong. I've watched a plethora of old 50s, 40s, you know, 60s and onwards science fiction materials. I mean, like from old B and C rated movies to, like, you know, reading about comics and books and all this other stuff. But after a while, it becomes some tropes that you can fall into with robot design. I mean, you either end up swinging into a very retro sci-fi look, or you end up swinging into a very anime, swoopy fiberglass kind of highly geometric look. And so I'm always trying to look for something that's a little bit more either organic or just different. I mean, and the problem is, creatively, it's almost impossible to find something new and exciting because the problem, you know, truthfully, just about everything's been done. And the real challenge comes in taking something that maybe exists or that's familiar to people, putting a spin on it, and creating something that at the exact same time is familiar yet also brand new. I think it was Doug Chiang on Star Wars Episode 1. When he started designing a lot of the tanks for the droid army and stuff, you could see that there was a definitive, there was some sort of line that was connecting all of them. And I didn't know when I saw the film the first time, I didn't really know what that thread was. It wasn't until much later in one of the books that I own that's about the art of Star Wars Episode 1, and even in some later interviews, that he talked about his consistent referencing back to animals. And I think, like, one of them, the droid tank that was used in the battle with the Gungans, that one, I think, was based on a sleeping or a crouching lion. And so there were elements like that that all this time I've started keeping in my head and thinking to myself, well, there's a lot of art that I'm really not familiar with. And one of the ones that, at the same time, puts a weird zone of, like, not real fear, but, like, and it's a welcome sort of discomfort, is African art. The reason I say that is because at the exact same time that I find it to be some of the most beautiful and just bizarre designs, it is a little nightmarish. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in a very good way. Like, because the kind of thing, not that it necessarily induces nightmares, it's the fact that it has this really cool and eclectic and odd thing that just, it's a little bit disheveling. It's a little bit, I don't even know the words, because it, at the exact same time that I'm absolutely drawn to it, there's elements of it that are just unsettling enough. And I think in a lot of ways, because of the fact that much of their art is just like a lot of other ones, like Native American or East Asian or whatever, those cultures tend to depict gods or goddesses, deities of any kind, you know, or monsters or, you know, or creatures that they believed in, you know, not unlike, you know, something like the Bunyip of Australia. And when you see these elements brought together and they've got these geometric patterns over, you know, overlaid and a distorted face of an animal or a human, you know, whatever it might be, those are the kinds of things that I look toward to influence what I try and work on. And so going places like that, and the reason I'm talking about all this, I guess I should have probably started this off from the beginning, so please pardon me on that. But the reason I'm saying this is because it's not just art that ends up influencing for me. A lot of times I can go to something like this and I start end up writing a story in my head. Characters start coming together. You know, ideologies and like, you know, maybe a path of a storyline starts to weave together. And I've actually done that a few times. When I really can take my time at a museum, and I can, believe me, if the museum's large enough, I can spend a good day or two going back and finding something new about it. And it gives my mind a chance to wander. I love to sit on benches and just stare at a painting if I can. I don't normally do that as often as I'd like anymore. I don't know if it's just because I'm, you know, just not in the right mindset. But when I remember whenever I used to have the time back when I was in college and I would make it up to the Nelson Atkins, there was actually, that's how I first fell in love with the Caravaggio that they do have there. And just being able to sit there and stare and look at the colors, look at the chiaroscuro, look at all these elements that were coming together to make this great, you know, this great, you know, painting. It's the same thing with a lot of the other things that are in the collection. And what was happening was it wasn't just influencing how I wanted my art to look or what I was aspiring to. And granted, my artwork is nowhere near the incredible body of work that you know, and style that Caravaggio has brought with his stuff. But there were still elements in there. His was almost sort of an early art noir sort of look with the real dark shadows and everything. And that was something that did end up playing into it. And through that, I ended up actually discovering the work of Timothy Bradstreet. He was a fairly prolific illustrator, pretty big in the 90s, still a hell of a heavy hitter in the illustration world. But he did, if any of you guys are familiar with The World of Darkness, he did a ton of the illustrations for that game series. It's basically, for those of you that don't know, it was a role-playing game that was pretty big in the mid to late 90s or something like that. And I was really huge into it, but there was like, you know, Vampire the Masquerade, Werewolf the Apocalypse. There was a slew of these different role-playing games and then later became a live-action role-playing game. But the point was that the artwork that he did for it was really, really stark, really stunning, really pretty shocking. I think he also did the work on War Journal, the Punisher graphic novel. I think. I don't really remember that right off the top of my head. But the thing was is that every single time I'll go to a museum, again, I'm consistently, you know, being inundated by different things and seeing something in a slightly different light. There was a painting, in fact, and I just noticed that today. As I was walking by, for some reason, it was hung up on the wall higher. And there's no notation on the information, you know, the little placards they'll put over to the side. There was no notation on there that, you know, because normally they'll go into things and tell you, like, weird little oddball things like, well, you know, this was painted on the coast of Sicily or something, or goes into the colors or the medium or whatever, or a little bit of the history of the artist or what they were doing at that particular time. Now, I don't know why this struck me as funny, you know, or not really funny, but just an odd little detail to notice. Because of the height of where the painting was, it was probably about 2 to 3 feet above me. I looked directly at it, and for the first time on anything that I had seen painted in oils, you could literally see where they had scratched a grid out. And it looked like maybe they had based the painting, you know, with an underpainting, and then had drawn in a grid of sorts to finish filling in the details for whatever the final forms that they were working on and working on again. So it struck me that that's the same sort of instruction that many of us have gotten in art class, you know, when we're in high school or even early college. And that, you know, there was this little bit of detail. Now, I know that to most people, that probably doesn't seem like a big deal, but it was refreshing to see that element, to see that little, you know, nuance come through, because I was like, oh, hey, there's a very human element there that isn't being explored. Well, for some reason, that whole concept started me working back on, like, well, you know, what is a grid? How does that break down? You know, and then I started thinking about, you know, the works of Picasso and Braque and other people that would essentially break down elements and create very distorted, very odd, you know, creations that were very much in motion, yet static, weird, geometric shapes. And that's the kind of thought process that goes through my head whenever I go to these places. Now, I don't know. You know, it's really weird. I find myself more and more whenever, as I'm getting older, and, you know, this is such a weird theme. This is absolutely going through so many of the different things I'm publishing is just getting older. But it's true. I marvel, and I kind of wish now that not only had I had the equipment, but the ability to really hear my own voice. Like, I've been blogging and keeping my website going for a very long time. I started it, you know, when I was 16. And so it's been quite a few years. But I wish that I could hear my own voice and had the capacity to have recorded myself back then, if only because I know that when I first started going to the museum, when I first started thinking about artwork, I was obsessed with a particular look. I was obsessed with just becoming the best I possibly could. So, you know, and there's so many parallels that can be drawn to other aspects of life in this way. But for me, I know that when I first got into wanting to become a professional artist, I would look at a lot of art, you know, that I saw. And most of what I was experiencing and exposed to was fantasy art. So it was stuff like Larry Elmore or, you know, Brahm especially. And I held it to myself, you know, oh, Alan Lee and John Howe, certainly. those people like that were the ones that I'd look at and I'd go, man, I really need to get to that point. I need that, you know, fairly realistic, almost bombastic sort of fantasy art. You know, that at that point in time, you know, I hadn't been fully, you know, exposed to people like Frazetta yet, or I had, but I didn't really know who he was, as dumb as that sounds. And so as I went on, you know, my journey of discovery and started figuring out more people like him and Boris and Julie Vallejo and finding more of that sort of thing, I was obsessed with the fact that, you know, okay, well, what am I doing wrong? Because I felt like I was a decent, you know, graphite and pencil renderer. I could do some stuff and I was getting better at it. I could work in charcoal and all. And, you know, when you're going through high school and college, you're experimenting with all these different sorts of mediums. And I found myself more and more frustrated because I wasn't really able to do what they did. I mean, I'd try. I certainly struggled. I've got reams of newsprint and old notebooks and scattered drawings everywhere that show that, boy, was I trying to do that. You know, I was trying to basically take a shortcut and get to that point. And come on, let's be honest, a lot of people do this. And sometimes the worst part about it is that we're not even aware that we're doing that. That's the big challenge, isn't it? And for those of you that have kids that are at that age where they're, you know, they're, you know, full of enough piss and vinegar to, you know, drive you nuts, that's the thing, isn't it? Because at that point, you know, and if you were into art or you were an artist at that point in time, you know, or thought you were going to be or whatever, you've probably thought similar things. I know I did. I mean, you know, I'm fairly lucky to still be making, you know, some money doing this. And you know, the crazy part is I was about to say have found my own voice, but I'm still growing. I'm still finding new things. And if anything, at first I thought I went to the museum to just discover answers about immediate issues I had. Well, it turned out that just like every single time I've ever gone, I end up finding answers to more existential things. Things that I hadn't really thought about. Like, well, what is my legacy? Where am I going with this? What do I want to get out of this? What am I getting out of it now? Am I getting anything out of it now? And because of that, I end up thinking more and more about the current work I'm doing. And it makes me self-analyze myself. It makes me come back and come to terms with things that I might very well be in denial about. And that's for anybody that can be, you know, in a medium where you have to put yourself out there. And truthfully, although I don't, you know, like when I do theater or when I do any kind of acting or anything, you're really putting yourself out there. I mean, just like, you know, opening up and putting myself out there on this podcast, you know, I have no idea how people react to that. I mean, thankfully, well, I do. I mean, thankfully people have been very kind and people have said, yeah, it's pretty good, you know, and that sort of thing. And, oh, you're not totally terrible to listen to. But the truth is that it's still very difficult. There's times whenever even the current work that I'm doing, I started doing let me break this down with my current work. I kind of switched it up and I went from doing some traditional stuff and I just jumped, you know, face first into a bunch of digital stuff. I'd been doing digital stuff, you know, prior and before with, you know, and see, you can tell how nervous I am because I said prior and before. That doesn't even make any sense. But I had really been thinking about moving into doing digital work because I would hold each line, you know, in creation and shape that I did as less precious because I knew I could unendingly, you know, control Z the hell out of it and just fix whatever was wrong with it. But I've also found that because of that, it's allowed me to open myself up and try a few things. Are they all successful? No, I don't think so. But they are evolving. They are changing. They are creating something new that I'm feeling fairly excited about. That's not to say that I'm walking away from traditional illustration. That will never happen. There is something visceral and beautiful about graphite on paper. There is something enticingly beautiful about scrawling ink across fresh paper. There's just, you can't get more primordial than that, shy of burning a stick and drawing on a rock. I mean, that's what it is for me. I know that when I was a kid, that was just what it was. And I think because that's so ingrained into me, I will always do that. I mean, you could come up with every fancy app in the world. You could do everything in the world for, you know, anything technological. I am still going to grab a pencil. I am still going to grab an empty book and draw on it. I always will. Now, getting back to what I was saying really quickly, it ended up, so, you know, it ended up doing this whole thing where it was making me question, okay, like, I'm walking through this museum and I keep arguing with myself, like, you know, what am I doing as an artist? You know, what are my plans? Do I plan on trying to make a living out of going to every comic convention under the sun, you know, and, you know, attending the opening of a Pepsi can? I mean, practically every single point I get. I mean, seriously, there's, you know, and I'm not making fun of anybody. There's people that make a living at that. It's like, what? You got this little comic show? I'm going to be there. Great. I'm glad people can do that. For me, I've never been able to really do that because I get burned out after a couple of weekends in a row. And as much as I've tried, I've had bad experiences where that just doesn't work out, or I'm just not able to keep up the energy that I need. It's funny because in a performance-based concept like podcasting or doing voiceover, I have energy to spare. When it comes to going to a show, I love, you know, interacting with people and doing all that sort of stuff, but I run aground really quickly when I'm trying to get enough time to write stories, develop characters, and create artwork. I'll go through these horrible moments. It's just these, I can't even really describe it, but it's not depression as much as it is almost this inability to get things out because I'm so obsessed with trying to make sure that they're working right. Which, you know, in an earlier podcast, I talked about idea debt. There is that. But the difference in this is that I almost end up hamstringing myself because I don't even know how to begin to start working again. And I know that seems really weird. I mean, I went out of my way to make sure, like, with even this studio space that I've designed, that I would have a lot of things at my fingertips and be able to do that. And this is true because I have seen my productivity go up. But it didn't necessarily answer the question as to what I'm trying to do with myself as an artist. This is something that I believe everybody asks themselves, if not other people. And the crazy part is, I started to realize that I've been asking myself this for a hell of a long time, and I still have no answer. I don't know if I'm supposed to have an answer. I really don't. And, you know, maybe the thing that's coming out of this for me is the fact that it's a slow realization that, you know, and this is going to sound weird. We all go into art and we have something to say. For, you know, for those of us that are willing to be artists and put ourselves out there, there are some people that just want to do it as a hobby or as a pastime. It's relaxing, you know, or be like George Bush and just paint, you know, and then sell the stuff and help veterans or whatever he does now with it. There's always a reason to make art, if only for the reason of making art. But if you live your life and you want to do more with it, I think the question that I started raising myself was, because of two young gentlemen, and I'm paraphrasing because I wrote it down and I'm, you know, extremely scatterbrained right now, but there were these two guys that were in front of me. We'll just call them Bro 1 and Bro 2. The first guy was, they were looking at this, I can't, you know, this is how bizarre and disparaging the whole thing was, for me anyway, and to, probably to those of you that aren't artists that are listening to this, you'd be like, I don't get it, what's the big deal? But what happened was, Bro number one, and I don't mean that in a bad way, this is just my only way of describing them, and Bro number one in the front, it's these two guys are standing in front of me, and there's this painting in front, and I had this, and a lot of the paintings in the Nelson Atkin are very old, and this one had a very ornate carved wood frame around it. And the piece itself was a beautiful landscape. I do remember that, which one I couldn't tell you or who the artist was because everything they said just rattled me. So Bro One starts off and he was like, dude, you know, look at this frame. Look at how ornately carved it is. And the other one's like, right? I mean, like, this, you know, like this makes the painting part looks like it's totally easy. And the other guy's like, oh, dude, like, for sure. Like, you know, when you're, you'd have, you know, like carving, man. Like, dude, I'd much rather do the painting because, like, you know, fuck this shit. You know, they're talking about the goddamn frame. And so the other guy was like, you know, they must have had a lot of free time. And the other guy was like, oh, totally, for sure, you know, because all the artists back then were rich. And, like, everything in my head and my heart, everything inside me just, like, crumpled up like tinfoil. Now, it didn't bug me, but I didn't even know where to begin. I wanted to tap him on the shoulder and be like, okay, I want you just, everything you just said, I want you to stop. Because I would love to tell you how everything you just thought was wrong. That makes me sound like such a complete and genuine jerk, but I don't mean it to come off that way. But hearing that sort of crazy rhetoric come out was no different than the guy that I ran into, and I think that was either at a Walmart or Toys R Us. I think it was the Toys R Us that was telling his kid it was an M1 Abram tank, a little toy tank, you know, used in Desert Shield, you know, during the Clinton administration, and he erroneously explained to his son, that is the type of tank that we used whenever we were fighting the Vietnam War and we killed Hitler. Another aneurysm-inducing moment in my life. The thing is, when I see that kind of stuff, and there is a crazy point to all of my storytelling, the reason that that gets me is, and I've had to come to terms with this, as much as I was trying to walk through and figure out what the hell I was trying to do with myself, something that started to dawn on me is, maybe with everything that's happening, from the abolishment of the National Endowment for the Arts to people in Kansas lobbing grenades at anything that looks like art, and I mean that in a not real physical sense, in a very sarcastic one, to just the overall consensus that art is easy. I think what I'm beginning to discover is I enjoy talking to people at shows. I enjoy interacting with people because it gives me an opportunity to not only speak up about what I do, but what other people do. I can't tell you the number of times that I have talked about other artists that I'm with at the show in a very good way. When I tell people, well, cool, okay, if you liked my work, here's this other person, or here's this, or have you been to this show? Every show I do, StealthCon, I was talking about NakaCon, the show I had just done. I was also talking about Planet. I was talking about TopCon. I was talking about all of these other shows that were happening to people that maybe had never been around it, maybe didn't have any exposure to it, whatever the case might be. The exact same thing is what I do with my art, and it started making me realize that I really do enjoy speaking to people about art, and maybe trying to change how their perception is. Because I know that there's a lot of people, and I don't know where this comes from. They may see a price tag, and, you know, like, let's say that, you know, and I do have some pieces that are like this, like my Tank Girl piece, the original is $1,500. And that may seem like an outlandish price, like, yeah, who's going to pay $1,500 for that? Well, you never know, dude. I remember, and granted, I am no Donato, but I remember the very first Spectrum Fantastic Art Live, I remember seeing a collector buy one of his pieces in person. I saw it. I believe it was the Gandalf piece. And that rocked me to my core. It was a couple thousand dollars. And it was like, boom, there, it's gone. It's gone. That now belongs to that dude for X amount of dollars. And couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Donato, goddamn brilliant American master. Just, the dude is amazing. But my point is, in seeing that, and in seeing other masters sell their artwork and stuff like that, there is a genuine value, and it's not just to art collectors. It's not just the hope that at some point in time you're going to keel over and they'll be able to sell that on the black market or to a normal market or whatever and make some money off of it. No, there's a real appreciation out there. But what there is a growing lack of is an education concept of what exactly is art and why do we need it. And I've gone on before about this, how art is all around us and all these other things. There's that. But I don't believe, and this, man, if we're going to get real talk here real quick, one of the things that can be really frustrating, and I know this is for all of you young artists out there. If you're in a situation where your parents don't understand what the hell you're doing, or your siblings don't understand what you're doing, get used to it. That's not changing. It's just not. I mean, at some point they'll start to be okay with you, but that's because you start earning a paycheck. It really has nothing to do with the fact that your creative virtuoso has come out and you're now the most celebrated man in Paris. No, that has nothing to do with it. Nothing. They want to see that you're going to be fine. And that's what families are supposed to do. They're supposed to be there to really question your own sanity and make sure that what you're doing, that you out there punting art to the, you know, to the great unwashed masses is anything that makes sense. If anything, it really doesn't, because that's a goddamn challenging thing to do. And that still is something that I come across, because I was trying to picture that. I was like, these two yahoos that were in front of me criticizing this, you know, this whole outlook, or not criticizing, but just redefining their version of what it must be like to be an artist carving goddamn, you know, freaking frames and no, the painting's easy. I could run across them at Planet Comic Con. I mean, Planet Comic Con draws in like, what, 70,000 people? They're bound to be in that goddamn mix somewhere, and I'm probably going to end up at my table and probably question everything I do. And I'm not saying that to be egotistical. I'm saying that to be a reality, because I've had those kind of run-ins with people. And not bad, but not great, where people just don't understand what you're trying to do. They don't understand what that... Why would you do that? And why would you charge that much for it? You know, I've literally had people say, well, you know, yeah, but that's a lot of money. Yes, it is. Yes, it is a lot of money. And you know why? Because those are 22 or 13 or 2 hours of my life that I spent doing that. And I was about to say that I can't get back, but no, there's no getting back that. I would not want it back, because the journey of creating that artwork was worth it. But the fear we have, and this is pervasive among a lot of artists, one of the things that I'll tend to do is if I go to a show, I do try to make sure that I'm at least kind of looking at what everyone else has got their prices at. Now, don't get me wrong. I set my own prices based on the worth that I believe I deserve to get for it. I mean, I've been a working artist for a long time. I've got a lot of experience, and I've worked hard to try and develop and create things that I believe people would like. You can't please everyone. This is true. But you can put a value that is worthwhile. At that same time, understand that you can also have too much ego and too big of a swollen head, and you can price yourself right out of the goddamn market. Because in no way, shape, or form am I going to go to a show like Spectrum Fantastic Art Live or any other major gallery show or something like that where there would be people that are essentially, you know, masters in the field of illustration or, you know, studio painting or whatever, and dare try and approach those prices, because I'm still a student in a lot of ways. I mean, we all are. But I still consider myself that in certain disciplines and certain mediums. Now, swinging for the pitch, you know, if I'm doing a comic, I'm going to charge a decent price because I feel I'm, you know, that I'm a fairly competent and fairly good comic artist. Not prolific, but I am pretty good at it. And that being said, that was all of that wrapped up together, guys, is where I started thinking about, you know, I may not be a household name after I'm gone. I may not be a household name now or even in a few years, but that isn't really what I'm about. I don't care for the fame. I don't care to be known. I would like to be, you know, the beautiful way to put it that I thought was there was a panel with Phil Lamar, and he talked about, this was a Stealth Con, and a buddy of mine, Aaron, had told me, it was either Aaron or, I think it was my buddy Aaron that told me this, that said that, he said he wasn't famous, but he said he was popular, because he attributed it to being a football player at like a medium sized town, and you're the star quarterback. You're getting all that attention, all that adulation, all of that, but you move and you go to a different town. Suddenly you're nothing. And that's so true. I don't care if you're talking about voice acting or art or anything. Every new show I go to, every new venue I go to, every new area I'm in, I have to prove myself. I prove myself through the artwork and what I do and my, you know, my overall life view and what I'm putting out there. And that can be incontestably one of the hardest things to do, because it's like starting all over again. And at the same time that it's scary, it's probably also a little refreshing, riveting, and also just the best kind of mind-blowing experience you can have. Because you end up opening yourself up to a bunch of people that have never seen your stuff, and you have no idea how they're going to react. And that's probably, for me anyway, one of the more enjoyable things. And I don't really get a chance to do that since I sort of do the same circuit of shows right now and have done for a while. I wouldn't mind kind of jumping back out now that my work's evolved over a few years and see what sort of impact and what sort of reaction I get from some other areas. And I guess, to end this, I apologize, I've spoken in this crazy wide spectrum of thoughts. Maybe the thing that I really learned from today is that, there's going to be people out there that maybe have no idea what art really is, and so they're going to argue over a frame. And there may be people that only end up in a museum, and the only reason that their artwork is there is because it's old. And let's be honest, that's usually the case with some of these people. You're like, I didn't even know this guy was a postmodernist. Yeah, probably his neighbor didn't either when he was alive, or whatever. But the point is, I think I ended up facing one of my biggest insecurities, which is everything I'm doing right now worth it? And that sounds, now that I'm saying it, it's almost like, this weight lifted off my shoulders to a degree. And I can feel it. It's like butterflies in my stomach. But it's true. We try so hard. And in this world right now where, social media makes us all think that we are goddamn rock stars. Every one of us. If you're on social media, you start to crave the attention. You start to, refresh pages and saying, oh, God, did I get likes on this or whatever? Or did anyone retweet me on Twitter? I'm really bad about that. Twitter is my big thing right now. And it's weird. Because we've ended up manufacturing a situation where we are very much self-comprised upon our own popularity. And we almost want, I really feel for any kids that are growing up now, because you live in an age where you can get instantaneous gratification. But here's the thing. For anything that really matters, that is not how it works. Not really. Because you can watch as many videos as you want about musicians, artists, visual artists, the world's greatest gymnast or martial artist, or the world's fastest, streetcar racer. But you're just watching the adventures of people doing this stuff. That doesn't make you any more acclimated to the culture, to the scene, to the concept, to the ideas that are happening. It doesn't make you friends. It doesn't make a real connection there, at least not instantaneously. At the same time that I celebrate how open information is and how there's a plethora of it out there that can be experienced and researched and pulled up at a moment's notice on our phones, I also fear that that is one of the reasons why art is now underappreciated. Because you can literally Google anybody, anything, anyhow, anywhere, and get instantaneous gratification. And art has really become so just overwhelmed by it. I mean, the crazy bit is, and this is something that I've often wondered, I've had people tell me before, I'll never forget this, and I will probably end it with this because, I don't know that any one of you have really held on listening to me drone for almost 40 minutes, but something that really woke me up to this that kind of freaked me out a little bit was when I create artwork, I'm very, very happy for the people that like my art, that, want to buy it, do all this other stuff. Great. But do you know that I've actually had people at shows and in interactions otherwise that have not bought my artwork? But here's why. And I've actually had more people not buy my stuff than buy my stuff. That's just the rule of selling art. But here's something that really kind of disheveled me a little bit a while back. And I may have spoken about this before, so I apologize if I'm retreading some ground here. But I ran into a person who actually told me that the reason they didn't buy my artwork was because of the fact that it was something they couldn't do. That was absolutely bizarre to me, because they showed me later, this was at a show, they showed me some artwork that they had bought from another artist who they were certain they could do that level of work. So that was what they were going to hang in their home. Now, the work they had bought, not being rude, it was probably about senior high school level type art. And that's not a bad thing per se. But if you're out there at a show And you're thinking, well, as long as I do really good work, I should be able to outstrip and outmaneuver and outsell people that maybe are, at least from a discipline level, you know, on a lower state than I am. That's not necessarily the case. And something that it puzzled me so much that I ended up talking to a friend of mine who knows quite, you know, a bit about human psychology and emotive responses. And the crazy part was that he said, well, no, that's actually a byproduct of this whole narcissistic aspect that we have because of the, you know, the whole Facebook, Twitter, especially Instagram and Snapchat world that we live in. And what happens is that there are some people that can't get past that. You know, it's this thing of like, well, I can do it too. And when they run across something that they genuinely can't do, they're not quite sure how to handle that. To some degree, they could either end up reinvesting and doubling down on themselves, saying, well, I could do that, but I just don't want to do that. And so they kind of begrudgingly accept it. On the other side, they could just completely ignore it or just be like, well, no, it sucks and I don't want to do that. So, or whatever the case might be. And it's almost like, you know, living in a world full of, you know, failed movie critics who may at one point in time have been, you know, aspiring directors or something else along that line. And was that seriously not like the loudest motorcycle ever? Man, I swear to God, like I've got to work on the soundproofing in this studio a little bit more. Sorry about that. At any rate, getting back to what I was saying, God, I should totally edit that out, but that was just so bizarre. I was like, what? There's the feedback on this line? But the crazy part is I think that there are a lot of times, and I had always suspected that that might be an issue, and I'm not saying that's a widespread thing. I don't mean that in a way to piss off anybody. It's just something that I've had happen to me. Probably, definitely once, probably twice now. I may have pushed the other one out of my memory. But thankfully, the vast majority of people that are out there are kind enough and do understand enough. Like, because one thing I get is a lot of people are like, oh, I could never do this. No, don't say that. Art is a skill. I will never forget. Really good artist, Greg Manchess. Freaking amazing dude. Does a lot of work for National Geographic and tons of other clients. He's often said there's no such thing as talent. I do believe that, to a degree. When he gets really mad and people say, oh, you're so talented, this just comes to you. No. The concept of talent means that I didn't have to work for this. I have certainly, and as he would say, he was like, I've certainly painted enough paintings and drawn enough things to make it to where I am skilled enough to be able to do what I do. To say that there is some sort of innate, and this isn't necessarily a strike at anything religious, but to sit there and say, oh, that's a God-given talent. Oh, well, that you know, he just comes from a long family of illustrators. You know what? That's cool. That's great. There's nothing to be said about that. I can say I went to school with a girl who was formidable, formidable at painting. You could argue that, and I'm not going to say the last name just because of the fact that they are a very well-known family of illustrators, very, very well-known, like 3 to 4 generations worth. And the thing was, the people that had come before her were professionals in the field. Man, they could hold anything. She, on the other hand, was more interested in being part of a sorority house. And there's nothing wrong with that either, except that that just kind of ruled her life. She was more interested in that, more interested in partying, more interested in all these other sort of things, and really just kind of threw away the fact that she was this incredibly good at art. So the skill that was lacking was any sort of discipline, was any sort of real want and desire to make something of this, because Lord knows that kegger next Sunday or Saturday was way more goddamn important than getting in this illustration that even though she turned it in at the last minute, still looked amazing, but she missed the deadline. And in a professional world, that's not going to fly. It's really not. It doesn't matter about your name. It doesn't matter about those sort of things. Sometimes it does, but when it really counts deep down inside, it doesn't. And that's, you know, so, man, it's crazy. I don't even mean to turn these things into these crazy rants or, you know, go off as long as I have, but it's been a long time since I've been able to just kind of cut loose on one of these. So I guess I'm just kind of going to let this one run for a little while longer. So anyway, I thought that in a lot of ways, the visit to the museum ended up answering a lot of questions that I wasn't comfortable with. And the main one was, you know, how am I applying myself and what am I making of my own art? You know, am I taking myself seriously? Because that's the weird thing. I mean, I used to think about when I was younger and I had this, you know, crazy, almost myopic vision to get out there and just draw. And every single chance I'd be sitting in like history class drawing. And I think now that I think back to it, I was like so freaking disrespectful to not only, you know, my fellow students, but especially my instructors and teachers. And that was never cool. And I'm laughing it off now, partially out of embarrassment, partially out of like, Jesus, kids do dumb things. But, you know, now when I look at it, you know, art can sometimes be a little bit more of a trial, or it can be a little bit more tedious. And that's crazy because, I mean, I do love doing art. I really do. And when I have my Zen moments and maybe I just turn on some music and I'm listening to a soundtrack, or it's just really quiet down here and that sort of thing, I can really get into it and I really enjoy it. And that's like, it's like the same high as when I, you know, might be out somewhere and then all of a sudden I'll see something that'll trigger a poem and I start writing. And then something that, you know, if I tried to force it, it would take me days to figure something out. I could write a bit of prose in maybe 15, 20 minutes, and it would be in a really good, rough, functioning state. It's no different than a wonderful sketch that comes together just at the right moment. I mean, the lighting's right, I just ate some good food, or the moment's good, you know, or there's good positivity around, or I've just been laughing earlier. So, you know, that sort of drives that thing. And we're very much victims of our own environment. And I've tried everything I can to make sure that my environment is conducive to me creating better artwork. But the truth is that you could have all the best tools, all the best things in the world, and if your heart isn't in it, you're not going to do it. So then that was the other part of it was, well, how much of my heart is really involved in what I create? Because if I'm not making things that are making me happy, and I'm consistently looking for the bottom dollar and trying to sell things to people that, you know, will work, then what the hell am I doing? I mean, that probably goes right back to people that I see selling a ton of fan art or stuff like that. You know, that's great. If that's what you guys like, fantastic. But I think that there's a lot more to be said about going into Artist Alley and seeing a lot of other things. And don't get me wrong, I've sold just as much fan art as anybody else, because sometimes you're trying really hard, you're trying to put something original out there, but if you don't believe in it as much, or maybe people just aren't resonating with it, it either means it's A, not the best or most becoming idea, or, you know, or B, you're just not able to sell as much, or maybe C, you know, maybe it's just not the right thing for a multitude of reasons. And then it comes down to, well, so can I commission you and you draw me Spider-Man riding a donkey into space and punching Omega Supreme? And you just kind of go, you know what, I don't even care. Okay, that's a total mashup of fandoms and whatever, that's fine. $35 color, $25 if you just want black and white, and yeah. And that you end up settling for that. And I've done that. And that's not knocking anybody. If somebody wants that, I'll draw it. I mean, yeah, it's fine. But it does kind of throw, you know, after a few years, you don't want to do that anymore. After a few years, you kind of hope that you have enough savvy and enough mindset to be able to create something that's compelling enough that people want to read it. I mean, I always go back to what Bill Watterson said. And again, I am not comparing myself to Bill Watterson. I am saying that Bill Watterson did say, if you're going to do something, for God's sake, you know, people have better things to do than read your comic book or read your comic strip. So please make it funny, make it entertaining, make it good. And I think that's the thing to take away from it, is make it something that you really, truly believe in. And this is something that I'm consistently freaking re-educating myself about. I'm not sitting here from the pulpit telling you guys, follow my example. Oh, hell no. Please don't do that. There's a ton of people that often, and I get this sort of thing, and I'm like, I'm not as put together as you guys think I am. I do a lot of things, but at the same time that I'm doing those things, I'm consistently trying to play catch up with myself. And there's times whenever I do succeed and get some things done and get stuff created and things like that. But if you guys could actually, which is what I'm attempting to do to a certain degree, show you guys behind the scenes, like how nutty some things can be, or how off-putting some of my, you know, other things could be, like, you know, just whether it sometimes be the occasional procrastination to serious moments of self-doubt to technical issues that plague me from either, you know, me being really bad for electronics, or just me forgetting where things are, or just messing up a piece of artwork on accident, you guys would cringe. I mean, seriously. And I think a lot of people have the exact same issues that I have. So I'm nothing unique in that respect. But I'm beginning to understand more and more now that maybe, you know, one of the things that could be a clarion call for me is educating people and helping people understand that, hey, there's a very human element to what art is. It is absolutely worth prices that artists will ask, for the most part. There's always that little caveat you have to throw in there because you know there's going to be some jackass. And I'm going to call his ass out now. This dude, not by name, but by nickname. His name was Nailboy. I'll tell you guys the story real quick, and then I'm gonna shut this podcast off because my throat is going crazy, and I've been talking too damn long. So here's the story of Nailboy. Nailboy was basically this guy, and I'll never forget how he spoke because everything about him was like this, and he spoke in this weird kind of way. Well, what happened was, it was at the show, and I don't even think this art show was around. I'm trying to remember where it was. It was on the Kansas side. At any rate, it was a show that had been around for 5-7 years, and I remember hearing this like weird whacking noise, like this hammer on. I thought, is there construction going on? What's going on? This can't be good. We got an art show going on. And it was the kind of art show where they give you a breakfast in the morning and all this other stuff. You set up a tent outside, you know, all that sort of the grid walls, whatever. Well, this guy, Nailboy, kind of looked like a guy that was trying too hard to audition for Green Day. He was over to the side. His whole thing was these cutout forms of plywood. They were guitars, drum sets, animals, whatever. And he had painted in like either tempera or latex house paint. I'm not sure what. This weird crude version of whatever it was. So it was like these flat colors. Now, that in and of itself was not that terrible. What he did do was then he just covered the entire facing of it with brad nails and tacks and you know, penny nail, anything, basically wide-headed nails of all kinds that he could find to create various textures. Again, not offensive, not necessarily the most original idea, but not a terrible one. What got me was the dude was so completely full of himself. And I've only ever seen, it does remind me of another story, but I might have to say that one, depending on how fast I get through this one. It does remind me of how sometimes people will buy into that. And what got me was that the people that were running the show were totally in love with this guy. And they proved it by giving him best in show. He won like a cash award. The dude was consistently late every day the show was on, opening up his tent late, talking to people, and he just had this rude sort of like, I'm a flat tire kind of attitude about life. And it was the most annoying thing in the world because he was so into being an artist that I can't even explain it. You know, I'm not one for violence, but man, did this dude have the most punchable face I've ever seen in my life. And that's terrible to say that. It's terrible. But it was just accentuated by the fact that he had this attitude of like, well, I'm, you know, my work is just, it's just the thing. And I'm trying to remember some things he talked about, but even his interview, it was clear that, you know, he was trying to put a lot more into what he created, and it didn't come out right. And there's times when you'll hear people talk about their art. You'll hear that, and you don't really hear any passion. You don't really hear anything else in there aside from the fact that they're very much playing the I'm just out of art school sort of, you know, I'm an underrated thespian, but an overrated, you know, talent kind of an ordeal. And it was just bad. And the thing is, the horribly annoying thing about this was that he got the recognition, the money, the award. And there were tons of people that were in attendance at the show that were vastly superior to him in not only how they accomplished their artwork, but also how they put together their show, their presentation, and everything. And the only other person that's ever really come that close, and this, I believe, may have been at a Spectrum show, but it may have been at AlexCon up in Pennsylvania. It was a dude. No, yeah, it was the same guy. Not this same guy, Nailboy, but another dude. And this guy, he spoke with this weird accent. At any rate, he kind of spoke like he was like a lost member of the Rolling Stones or something. But you've got a voice like this. And he spoke about things, and you know, you assumed that he had had way too many, you know, whiskey, gin, and tonics or something like that whenever he talked. But the thing was, this dude wore no shirt. He had really tight leather pants on, cowboy boots kind of, you know, pulled over them. And he had a leather jacket on the whole time, but no shirt. And I can't stress this enough because I've never seen a shirtless artist at any show. And this dude had no shirt. And so he's got these like aviator sunglasses. And the thing was, his overall look and appearance was not that bad, but he had rented out these two booth spaces. and he had no table that I could recall, but everything was pushed against the wall, and he had this giant easel that the glass, that was glass, I think he was painting on glass in the center of it. And he had this radio blasting. Everyone's just having interactions and talking to each other and just trying to have a good time. And this dude's rocking out to like Marilyn Manson and Rob Zombie. And, you know, the music wasn't terrible, but he's literally hip thrusting. I'm actually doing it right near the microphone, but he's hip thrusting and gyrating toward the glass panel on the easel in front of him. You know, and if you could just picture, you know, some Rob Zombie music, you know, kind of thumping along, and he's just kind of sitting there, like kind of like ducking his head back and forth, like, you know, like a chicken. And he's got this palette, this glass, and he's like flinging paint on there and everything. And this girl comes over and she's like, "Oh my God, what are you doing?" He's like, "Oh, I'm totally like, you know, I'm really getting into the mood here. You know, you need those vibes. You need that music just coursing through your veins." But he never stopped thrusting his hips as he's talking to this lady. It looked rather obscene from the other side. But the best part about it was when, and at some of these shows for the big name artists, I don't even remember his name. Clearly he was somebody of some import. Especially in the shirtless category. But this guy, he evidently went and got his photo taken with a lot of these other artists. And I know I've got it stored somewhere on a hard drive. Again, I don't remember this guy's name. But he took two pictures. And this was a while back. But in the portfolio, you could see these two pictures. The first one, I'm trying to imagine what he was telling the photographer. I think the first one he was like, "Okay, right. So what I want to do is I want you to take a picture of me as if like I'm standing in the windy city of Chicago, and like, you know, the wind is just too much, and I'm gonna like throw back me jacket, you know, if that works for you," because that's exactly what the fuck he did. The picture is him, and he's like kind of like Michael Jackson would kind of like whip his jacket off and go, "Oh," that kind of a thing. He did that. We minus the Michael Jackson, you know, yodel, but he threw it back like that. And so like just nipple rings flipped forward and like, you know, just stand there. He's got like this like kind of like look on his mouth. And it was the most surreal thing, because after that, he was like, "Right, you got off that one? Okay, cool. I've got another one for you." And so he readjusts these giant, and don't get me wrong, I wear some oversized crazy rings too. I love that aesthetic, the whole biker thing. But yeah, these giant skull ones, like these Keith Richard looking rings on this one hand. And he made this motion where he had one shoulder completely bare now. And so you could see 3/4 of his chest and stomach and everything else like that, and these super tight leather pants. And no shirt. And so he's making this punching action toward the photographer. And I have to say this. Unlike Nail Boy, this guy was highly entertaining, because there was a part of me that wanted to believe that this whole act that he had going on was just that. Nail Boy had an act. He had a thing. He had some sort of trademark. But it was not right. It was not good. It was pretty crappy. This other dude lived it and breathed it. And the scary part was that was probably really him. You know, it was like an extension. It was not just an extension of him. That was just how he was. I pictured that I'm certain when you go home, he's like, "What the hell's a closet? You know, like, what do you need that for?" He has no shirts. So that was pretty shocking. My point is that with those two different things, you know, it's believing yourself and having enough ego to get out there and do that sort of artwork and that kind of performance-based presentation. But one came off far more genuine than the other. And at the end of it, see, this is what happens when you go to the museum. At least it happened to me. You end up thinking about, like, you know, guys that nail nails into wood and shirtless dudes that like to pretend like they're punching camera equipment. You know what? That really is strange. I don't even know how the hell I got to that from the Nelson Atkins Museum. But if anything, that tells you, go to the museum, because you'll end up thinking strange thoughts and maybe recording them in a podcast and doing what I did. So now running at an hour, I'm going to let you guys go. Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. I am so sorry that this one took this long, but not really, because I enjoy talking on the microphone. You can find me on Twitter at The Artisan Rogue. You can also go to my website at www.theartisanrogue.com. Thanks so much. You can also email me at mario@mariomora.net. And if you have any questions, comments, or, you know, you just want to say, "Hey, man, just stop doing your podcast," I'd like to hear that too. You might soon be able to catch me in some other areas, but I'll be letting you guys know more about that. For right now, thank you for listening. I'm Mario the Artisan Rogue for Radio 74.